those third and fourth arch nerves, among them the glossopharyngeal and vagus, follow the same pattern as the ones in front, each going to structures that developed from the arch they are associated with. This fundamental blueprint of heads helps us make sense of one of the apocryphal tales in anatomy. In 1820, so the story goes, Johannes Goethe was walking through the Jewish cemetery in Vienna when he spotted the decomposing skeleton of a ram. The vertebrae were exposed, and above them lay a damaged skull. Goethe, in a moment of epiphany, saw that the breaks in the skull made it look like a gnarled mess of vertebrae. To Goethe, this revealed the essential pattern within. The head is made up of vertebrae that fused and grew a vault to hold our brains and sense organs. This was a revolutionary idea because it linked heads and bodies as two versions of the same fundamental plan. The notion must have been in the drinking water in the early 1800s because other people, among them Lorenz Oken, allegedly came up with virtually the same idea in a similar setting. Goethe and Oken were both picking up something very profound, although they could not have known it at the time. Our body is segmented, and this pattern is most clearly seen in our vertebrae. Each vertebra is a block that represents a segment of our body. The organization of our nerves is also segmental, correlating closely with the pattern of the vertebrae. Nerves exit the spinal cord to supply the body. The segmental configuration is obvious when you look at the levels of the spinal cord that are associated with each part of our body. For example, the muscles in our legs are supplied by nerves that exit from lower parts of the spinal cord than those that supply our arms. Heads may not look it, but they also contain a very deep segmental pattern. Our arches define segments of bones, muscles, arteries, and nerves. Look in the adult, and you won't see this pattern. We see it only in the embryo. Our skulls lose all overt evidence of their segmental origins as we go from embryo to adult. The plate-like bones of our skulls form over our gill arches, and the muscles, nerves, and arteries, which all had a very simple segmental pattern early on, are rewired to make our adult heads. Knowing something about development can help us predict where to look for what is missing in children who have certain birth defects. For example, children born with first arch syndrome have a tiny jaw and non-functioning ears with no malleus or incus bone. Missing are structures that normally would have formed from the first arch. The arches are the roadmap for major chunks of the skull, from the most complicated cranial nerves to the muscles, arteries, bones, and glands inside. The arches are also a guide to something else, our very deep connection with sharks. Our inner shark. The take-home message of many a lawyer joke is that lawyers are an especially voracious kind of shark. Teaching embryology during one of the recurring vogues for these jokes, I remember thinking that the joke is on all of us. We're all modified sharks. Or worse, there is a lawyer inside each of us. As we've seen, much of the secret of heads lies in the arches, the swellings that gave us the roadmap for the complicated cranial nerves and key structures inside the head. Those insignificant-looking swellings and indentations have captured the imagination of anatomists for 150 years because they look like the gill slits in the throat regions of fish and sharks. Fish embryos have these bulges and indentations too. In fish, the indentations ultimately open up to form the spaces between the gills where water flows. In us, the indentations normally seal over. In abnormal cases, gill slits fail to close and remain open as pouches or cysts. A branchial cyst, for example, is often a benign, fluid-filled cyst that forms in an open pouch inside the neck. The pouch is created by the failure of the third or fourth arch to close. Rarely, children are born with an actual vestige of an ancient gill arch cartilage, a little rod that represents a gill bar from the third arch. In these instances, my surgical colleagues are operating on an inner fish that unfortunately has come back to bite us. Every head on every animal from a shark to a human shares those four arches in development. The richness of the story lies in what happens inside each arch. Here, we can make a point-by-point comparison between our heads and those of sharks. Look at the first arch in a human and a shark, and you find a very similar state of affairs. Jaws. The major difference is that humans' first arch also forms some ear bones, which we do not see in sharks. Unsurprisingly, the cranial nerve that supplies the jaws of humans and sharks is in the first arch nerve, the trigeminal nerve. The cells inside the second gill arch divide, change, and give rise to a bar of cartilage and muscle. In us, the bar of cartilage breaks up to form one of the three bones of our middle ear, the stapes, and some other small structures at the base of the head and throat. One of these bones, called the hyoid, assists us in swallowing. Take a gulp, listen to music, and thank the structures that form from your second arch. In a shark, the second arch rod breaks up to form two bones that support the jaws, a lower one that compares with our hyoid, and an upper one that supports the upper jaw. If you have ever watched a great white shark try to chomp something, a diver in a cage, for example, you have probably noticed that the upper jaw can extend and retract as the shark bites. The upper bone of this second arch is part of the lever system of bones that rotate to make that possible. That upper bone is remarkable in another way, too. It compares with one of the bones in our middle ear, the stapes. Bones that support the upper and lower jaws in sharks are used in us to swallow and hear. As for the third and fourth arches, we find that many of the structures we use to talk and swallow are, in sharks, parts of tissues that support the gills. The muscles and cranial nerves we use to swallow and talk move the gills in sharks and fish. Our head may look incredibly complicated, but it is built from a simple and elegant blueprint. There is a pattern common to every skull on Earth, whether it belongs to a shark, a bony fish, a salamander, or a human. The discovery of this pattern was a major accomplishment of 19th century anatomy, a time when anatomists were putting embryos of all kinds of species under the microscope. In 1872, the Oxford anatomist Francis Maitland Balfour first saw the basic plan of heads when he looked at sharks and saw the bulges, the gill arches, and the structures inside. Unfortunately, he died soon after in a mountaineering accident in the Swiss Alps. He was only in his 30s. Gill arch genes. During the first 3 weeks after conception, whole batteries of genes are turned on and off in our gill arches and throughout the tissues that will become our future brain. These genes instruct cells to make the different portions of our head. Think of each region of our head as gaining a genetic address that makes it distinctive. Modify this genetic address, and we can modify the kinds of structures that develop there. For example, a gene known as OTX is active in the front region, where the first gill arch forms. Behind it, toward the back of the head, a number of so-called HOX genes are active. Each gill arch has a different complement of HOX genes active in it. With this information, we can make a map of our gill arches and the constellation of genes active in making each. Now we can do experiments. Change the genetic address of one gill arch into that of another. Take a frog embryo, turn off some genes, make the genetic signal similar in the first and second arches, and you end up with a frog that has two jaws. A mandible develops where a hyoid bone would normally be. This shows the power of the genetic addresses in making our gill arches. Change the address, and you change the structures in the arch. The power of this approach is that we can now experiment with the basic design of heads. We can manipulate the identity of the gill arches almost at will by changing the activity of the genes inside. Tracing heads from headless wonders to our headed ancestors. Why stop at frogs and sharks? Why not extend our comparison to other creatures, like insects or worms? But why would we do this when none of these creatures has a skull, much less cranial nerves? None of them even has bones. When we leave fish for worms, we get to a very soft and headless world. Bits of ourselves are there, though, if you look closely. Those of us who teach comparative anatomy to undergraduates usually begin the course with a slide of Amphioxus. Every September, hundreds of Amphioxus slides appear on screens in college lecture halls from Maine to California. Why? Remember the simple dichotomy between invertebrates and vertebrates? Amphioxus is a worm, an invertebrate, that shares many features with backboned animals such as fish, amphibians, and mammals. Amphioxus lacks a backbone, but like all creatures with backbones, it has a nerve cord that runs along its back. In addition, a rod runs the length of its body, parallel to the nerve cord. This rod, known as the notochord, is filled with a jelly-like substance and provides support for the body. As embryos, we have a notochord too, but unlike Amphioxus's, ours breaks up and ultimately becomes part of the discs that lie between our vertebrae. Rupture a disc, and the jelly-like substance of what was once a notochord can wreak havoc when it pinches nerves or interferes with the ability of one vertebra to move along the next. When we injure a disc, a very ancient part of our body plan is rupturing. Thanks a lot, Amphioxus. Amphioxus is not unique among worms. Some of the best examples are not in the oceans of today, but in ancient rocks of China and Canada. Buried in sediments over 500 million years old are small worms that lack heads, complex brains, or cranial nerves. They may not look like much, being small smudges in the rock, but the preservation of these fossils is incredible. When you look under a microscope, you find beautifully preserved impressions that display their soft anatomy in fine detail, occasionally even with impressions of skin. They show something else wonderful, too. They are the earliest creatures with notochords and nerve cords. These worms are telling us something about the origin of parts of our bodies. But there is something else we share with these little worms. Gill arches. Amphioxus, for example, has them in abundance, and associated with each arch is a little bar of cartilage. Like the cartilages that form our jaws, our ear bones, and parts of our voice box, these rods support the gill slit. The essence of our head goes back to worms, organisms that do not even have a head. What does Amphioxus do with the gill arches? It pumps water through them to filter out little particles of food. From so humble a beginning comes the basic structures of our own head. Just as teeth, genes, and limbs have been modified and their functions repurposed over the ages, so too as the basic structure of our head. Chapter 6. The Best Laid Body Plans. We are a package of about 2 trillion cells assembled in a very precise way. Our bodies exist in 3 dimensions, with our cells and organs in their proper places. The head is on top. The spinal cord is toward our back. Our guts are on the belly side. Our arms and legs are to the sides. This basic architecture distinguishes us from primitive creatures organized as clumps or disks of cells. The same design is also an important part of the bodies of other creatures. Like us, fish, lizards, and cows have bodies that are symmetrical, with a front-back, top-bottom, and left-right. Their front ends, corresponding to the top of an upright human, all have heads, with sense organs and brains inside. They have a spinal cord that runs the length of the body along the back. Also like us, they have an anus, which is at the opposite end of their bodies from the mouth. The head is on the forward end, in the direction they typically swim or walk. As you can imagine, anus forward wouldn't work very well in most settings, particularly aquatic ones. Social situations would be a problem, too. It is more difficult to find our basic design in really primitive animals, jellyfish, for example. Jellyfish have a different kind of body plan. Their cells are organized into discs that have a top and bottom. Lacking a front and back, a head and tail, and a left and right, jellyfish body organization appears very different from our own. Don't even bother trying to compare your body plan with a sponge. You could try, but the mere fact that you are trying would reveal something more psychiatric than anatomical. To properly compare ourselves with these primitive animals, we need some tools. Just as with heads and limbs, our history is written within our development from egg to adult. Embryos hold the clues to some of the profound mysteries of life. They also have the ability to derail my plans. The Common Plan: Comparing Embryos. I entered graduate school to study fossil mammals and ended up 3 years later studying fish and amphibians for my dissertation. My fall from grace, if you want to call it that, happened when I started to look at embryos. We had a lot of embryos in the lab. Salamander larvae, fish embryos, even fertilized chicken eggs. I'd routinely pop them under the microscope to see what was going on. The embryos of all the species looked like little whitish batches of cells, no more than an eighth of an inch long. It was exciting watching development progress. As the embryo got bigger, the yolk, its food supply, got smaller and smaller. By the time the yolk was gone, the embryo was usually big enough to hatch. Watching the process of development brought about a huge intellectual transformation in me. From such simple embryonic beginnings, small blobs of cells, came wonderfully complex birds, frogs, and trout comprising trillions of cells arranged in just the right way. But there was more. The fish, amphibian, and chicken embryos were like nothing I had ever seen before in biology. They all looked generally alike. All of them had a head with gill arches. All of them had a little brain that began its development with three swellings. All of them had little limb buds. In fact, the limbs were to become my thesis, the focus of my next 3 years' work. Here, in comparing how the skeleton developed in birds, salamanders, frogs, and turtles, I was finding that limbs as different as bird wings and frog legs looked very similar during their development. In seeing these embryos, I was seeing a common architecture. The species ended up looking different, but they started from a generally similar place. Looking at embryos, it almost seems that the differences among mammals, birds, amphibians, and fish simply pale in comparison with their fundamental similarities. Then I learned of the work of Carl Ernst von Baer. In the 1800s, some natural philosophers looked to embryos to try to find the common plan for life on Earth. Paramount among these observers was Carl Ernst von Baer. Born to a noble family, he initially trained to be a physician. His academic mentor suggested that he study chicken development and try to understand how chicken organs developed. Unfortunately, Von Baer could not afford incubators to work on chickens, nor could he afford many eggs. This was not very promising. Lucky for him, he had an affluent friend, Christian Pander, who could afford to do the experiments. As they looked at embryos, they found something fundamental. All organs in the chicken can be traced to one of three layers of tissue in the developing embryo. These three layers became known as the germ layers. They achieved almost legendary status, which they retain even to this day. Pander's three layers gave Von Baer the means to ask important questions. Do all animals share this pattern? Are the hearts, lungs, and muscles of all animals derived from these layers? And importantly, do the same layers develop into the same organs in different species? Von Baer compared the three layers of Pander's chicken embryos with everything else he could get his hands on: fish, reptiles, and mammals. Yes, every animal organ originated in one of these three layers. Significantly, the three layers formed the same structures in every species. Every heart of every species formed from the same layer. Another layer gave rise to every brain of every animal, and so on. No matter how different the species look as adults, as tiny embryos, they all go through the same stages of development. To fully appreciate the importance of this, we need to look again at our first 3 weeks after conception. At the moment of fertilization, major changes happen inside the egg. The genetic material of the sperm and egg fuses, and the egg begins to divide. Ultimately, the cells form a ball. In humans, over about 5 days, the single-cell body divides 4 times to produce a ball of 16 cells. This ball of cells, known as a blastocyst, resembles a fluid-filled balloon. A thin spherical wall of cells surrounds some fluid in the center. At this blastocyst stage, there still does not appear to be any body plan. There is no front and back, and certainly there are not yet any different organs or tissues. On about the 6th day after conception, the ball of cells attaches to its mother's uterus and begins the process of connecting to it so that mother and embryo can join bloodstreams. There is still no evidence of the body plan. It is a far cry from this ball of cells to anything you'd recognize as any mammal, reptile, or fish, much less a human. If we are lucky, our ball of cells has implanted in our mother's uterus. When a blastocyst implants in the wrong place, when there is an ectopic implantation, the results can be dangerous. About 96% of ectopic implantations happen in the uterine or fallopian tubes, near where conception happens. Sometimes mucus blocks the easy passage of the blastocyst to the uterus, causing it to implant improperly in the tubes. Ectopic pregnancy can cause various tissue ruptures if not caught in time. In really rare cases, the blastocyst is expelled into the mother's body cavity, the space between her guts and body wall. In even rarer cases, these blastocysts will implant on the outside lining of the mother's rectum or uterus, and the fetus develops to full term. Although these fetuses can sometimes be delivered by an abdominal incision, such implantation is generally very dangerous because it increases the risk of maternal death by bleeding by a factor of 90, as compared with a normal implantation inside the uterus. In any event, at this stage of development, we are extremely humble-looking creatures. Around the beginning of our 2nd week after conception, the blastocyst has implanted, with one part of the ball embedded in the wall of the uterus and the other free. Think of a balloon pushed into a wall. This flattened disc becomes the human embryo. Our entire body forms from only the top part of this ball, the part that is mushed into the wall. The part of the blastocyst below the disc covers the yolk. At this stage of development, we look like a frisbee, a simple two-layered disc. How does this oval frisbee end up with von Baer's three germ layers and go on to look anything like a human? First, cells divide and move, causing tissues to fold in on themselves. Eventually, as tissues move and fold, we become a tube with a folded swelling at the head end and another at the tail. If we were to cut ourselves in half right about now, we would find a tube within a tube. The outer tube would be our body wall, the inner tube our eventual digestive tract. A space, the future body cavity, separates the two tubes. This tube within a tube structure stays with us our entire lives. The gut tube gets more complicated, with a big sac for a stomach and long intestinal twists and turns. The outer tube is complicated by hair, skin, ribs, and limbs that push out. But the basic plan persists. We may be more complicated than we were at 21 days after conception, but we are still a tube within a tube, and all of our organs derive from one of the three layers of tissue that appeared in our second week after conception. The names of these three all-important layers are derived from their position. The outer layer is called ectoderm, the inner layer endoderm, and the middle layer mesoderm. Ectoderm forms much of the outer part of the body, the skin, and the nervous system. Endoderm, the inside layer, forms many of the inner structures of the body, including our digestive tract and numerous glands associated with it. The middle layer, the mesoderm, forms tissue in between the guts and skin, including much of our skeleton and our muscles. Whether the body belongs to a salmon, a chicken, a frog, or a mouse, all of its organs are formed by endoderm, ectoderm, and mesoderm. Von Baer saw how embryos reveal fundamental patterns of life. He contrasted two kinds of features in development: features shared by every species, and features that vary from species to species. Features such as the tube within a tube arrangement are shared by all animals with a backbone: fish, amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals. These common features appear relatively early in development. The features that distinguish us, bigger brains in humans, shells on turtles, feathers on birds, arise relatively later. Von Baer's approach is very different from the ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny idea you might have learned in school. Von Baer simply compared embryos and noted that the embryos of different species looked more similar to each other than do the adults of those species. The ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny approach, championed decades later by Ernst Haeckel, made the claim that each species tracked its evolutionary history as it proceeded through development. Accordingly, the embryo of a human went through a fish, a reptile, and a mammal stage. Haeckel would compare a human embryo to an adult fish or a lizard. The differences between the ideas of von Baer and Haeckel might seem subtle, but they are not. In the past 100 years, time and new evidence have treated von Baer much more kindly. In comparing embryos of one species to adults of another, Haeckel was comparing apples to oranges. A more meaningful comparison is one where we can ultimately uncover the mechanisms that drive evolution. For that, we compare embryos of one species to embryos of another. The embryos of different species are not completely identical, but their similarities are profound. All have gill arches, notochords, and look like a tube within a tube at some stage of their development. And, importantly, embryos as distinct as fish and people have Pander and von Baer's three germ layers. All of these comparisons lead us to the real issue at stake. How does the embryo know to develop a head at the front end and an anus at the back? What mechanisms drive development and make cells and tissues able to form bodies? To answer these questions required a whole new approach. Rather than simply comparing embryos as in von Baer's day, we had to find a new way of analyzing them. The latter part of the 19th century ushered in the era, which we first discussed in Chapter 3, when embryos were chopped, grafted, split, and treated with virtually every kind of chemical imaginable, all in the name of science. Experimenting with embryos. Biologists at the turn of the 20th century were grappling with fundamental questions about bodies. Where in the embryo does the information to build them lie? Is this information contained in every cell or in patches of cells? And what form does this information take? Is it a special kind of chemical? Beginning in 1903, the German embryologist Hans Spemann began to investigate how cells learn to build bodies during development. His goal was to find where the body-building information resides. The big question for Spemann was whether all the cells in the embryo have enough information to build whole bodies, or whether that information is confined to certain parts of the developing embryo. Working with newt eggs, which were easy to obtain and relatively easy to fiddle with in the lab, Spemann devised a clever experiment. He cut off a strand of his infant daughter's hair and made a miniature lasso out of it. Baby hair is remarkable stuff. Soft, thin, and pliant, it made the ideal material for tying up a tiny sphere such as a newt egg. Spemann did exactly that to a developing newt egg, pinching one side off from the other. Manipulating the nuclei of the cells a bit, he let the resulting contraption develop and watched what happened. The embryo formed twins. Two complete salamanders emerged, each with a normal body plan and each entirely viable. The conclusion was obvious. From one egg can come more than one individual. This is what identical twins are. Biologically, Spemann had demonstrated that in the early embryo, some cells have the capacity to form a whole new individual on their own. This experiment was only the beginning of a whole new phase of discovery. In the 1920s, Hilda Mangold, a graduate student in Spemann's laboratory, started to work with small embryos. The fine control she had of her fingers made her able to do some incredibly demanding experiments. At the stage of development with which Mangold worked, the salamander embryo is a sphere about a 16th of an inch in diameter. She lopped off a tiny piece of tissue, smaller than a pinhead, from one part of the embryo and grafted it onto the embryo of another species. What Mangold transplanted wasn't just any patch, but an area where cells that were to form much of the three germ layers were moving and folding. Mangold was so skilled that the grafted embryos actually continued to develop, giving her a pleasant surprise. The grafted patch led to the formation of a whole new body, including a spinal cord, back, belly, even a head. Why is all this important? Mangold had discovered a small patch of tissue that was able to direct other cells to form an entire body plan. The tiny, incredibly important patch of tissue containing all this information was to be known as the organizer. Mangold's dissertation work was ultimately to win the Nobel Prize, but not for her. Hilda Mangold died tragically. The gasoline stove in her kitchen caught fire before her thesis could even be published. Spemann won the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1935, and the award cites his discovery of the organizer and its effect in embryonic development. Today, many scientists consider Mangold's work to be the single most important experiment in the history of embryology. At roughly the same time that Mangold was doing experiments in Spemann's lab, W. Vogt, also in Germany, was designing clever techniques to label cells, or batches of them, and thus allow the experimenter to watch what happens as the egg develops. Vogt was able to produce a map of the embryo that shows where every organ originates in the egg. We see the antecedents of the body plan in the cell fates of the early embryo. From the early embryologists, people like von Baer, Pander, Mangold, and Spemann, we have learned that all the parts of our adult bodies can be mapped to individual batches of cells in the simple three-layered frisbee, and the general structure of the body is initiated by the organizer region discovered by Mangold and Spemann. Cut, slice, and dice, and you'll find that all mammals, birds, amphibians, and fish have organizers. You can even sometimes swap one species' organizer for another. Take the organizer region from a chicken and graft it to a salamander embryo. You get a twinned salamander. But just what is an organizer? What inside it tells cells how to build bodies? DNA, of course. And it is in this DNA that we will find the inner recipe that we share with the rest of animal life. Of flies and men. Von Baer watched embryos develop, compared one species to another, and saw fundamental patterns in bodies. Mangold and Spemann physically distorted embryos to learn how their tissues build bodies. In the DNA age, we can ask questions about our own genetic makeup. How do our genes control the development of our tissues and our bodies? If you ever thought that flies are unimportant, consider this. Mutations in flies gave us important clues to the major body plan genes active in human embryos. We put this kind of thinking to use in the discovery of genes that build fingers and toes. Now we'll see how it tells us about the ways entire bodies are built. Flies have a body plan. They have a front and a back, a top and a bottom, and so on. Their antennae, wings, and other appendages pop out of the body in the right place, except when they don't. Some mutant flies have limbs growing out of their heads. Others have duplicate wings and extra body segments. These are among the fly mutants that tell us why our vertebrae change shape from the head end to the anal end of the body. People have been studying abnormal flies for over 100 years. Mutants with one particular kind of abnormality got special attention. These flies had organs in the wrong places: a leg where an antenna should have been, an extra set of wings, or were missing body segments. Something was messing with their fundamental body plan. Ultimately, these mutants arise from some sort of error in the DNA. Remember that genes are stretches of DNA that lie on the chromosome. Using a variety of techniques that allow us to visualize the chromosome, we can identify the patch of the chromosome responsible for the mutant effect. Essentially, we breed mutants to make a whole population where every individual has the genetic error. Then, using a variety of molecular markers, we compare the genes of individuals with the mutation to those without. This allows us to pinpoint the region and the likely stretch of chromosome responsible for the mutant effect. It turns out that a fly has 8 genes that make such mutants. These genes lie next to one another on one of the long DNA strands of the fly. The genes that affect the head segments lie next to those that affect the segments in the middle of the fly, the part of the body that contains the wings. These bits of DNA, in turn, lie adjacent to the ones that control the development of the rear part of the fly. There is a wonderful order to the way the genes are organized. Their position along the DNA strand parallels the structure of the body from front to back. Now the challenge was to identify the structure of the DNA actually responsible for the mutation. Mike Levine and Bill McGinnis in Walter Gehring's lab in Switzerland and Matt Scott in Tom Kaufman's lab in Indiana noticed that in the middle of each gene was a short DNA sequence that was virtually identical in each species they looked at. This little sequence is called a homeobox. The 8 genes that contain the homeobox are called Hox genes. When the scientists fished around for this gene sequence in other species, they found something so uniform that it came as a true surprise. Versions of the Hox genes appear in every animal with a body. Versions of the same genes sculpt the front-to-back organization of the bodies of creatures as different as flies and mice. Mess with the Hox genes, and you mess with the body plan in predictable ways. If you make a fly that lacks a gene active in a middle segment, the midsection of the fly is missing or altered. Make a mouse that lacks one of the genes that specifies thoracic segments, and you transform parts of the back. Hox genes also establish the proportions of our bodies, the sizes of the different regions of our head, chest, and lower back. They are involved in the development of individual organs, limbs, genitalia, and guts. Changes in them bring about changes in the way our bodies are put together. Different kinds of creatures have different numbers of Hox genes. Flies and other insects have 8. Mice and other mammals, 39. The 39 Hox genes in mice are all versions of the ones that are found in flies. This similarity has led to the idea that the large number of mammalian Hox genes arose from a duplication of the smaller complement of genes in the fly. Despite these differences in number, the mouse genes are active from front to back in a very precise order, just as the fly genes are. Can we go even deeper in our family tree, finding similar stretches of DNA involved in making even more fundamental parts of our bodies? The answer, surprisingly, is yes. And it links us to animals even simpler than flies. DNA and the Organizer. At the time when Spemann won the Nobel Prize, the organizer was all the rage. Scientists sought the mysterious chemical that could induce the entire body plan. But just as popular culture has yo-yos and Tickle Me Elmo dolls, so science has fads that wax and wane. By the 1970s, the organizer was viewed as little more than a curiosity, a clever anecdote in the history of embryology. The reason for this fall from grace was that no one could decipher the mechanisms that made it work. The discovery of Hox genes in the 1980s changed everything. In the early 1990s, when the organizer concept was still decidedly unfashionable, Eddie DeRobertis' laboratory at UCLA was looking for Hox genes in frogs, using techniques like Levine and McGinnis's. The search was broad, and it netted many different kinds of genes. One of these had a very special pattern of activity. It was active at the exact site in the embryo that contains the organizer, and it was active at exactly the right time of development. I can only imagine what DeRobertis felt when he found that gene. He was looking at the organizer, and there in the organizer was a gene that seemed specifically to control it or be linked to its activity in the embryo. The organizer was back. Organizer genes started popping up in laboratories everywhere. While doing a different kind of experiment, Richard Harland at Berkeley found another gene, which he called Noggin. Noggin does exactly what an organizer gene should. When Harland took some Noggin and injected it into the right place in an embryo, it functioned exactly like the organizer. The embryo developed two body axes, including two heads. Are D. Robertus's gene and noggin the actual bits of DNA that make up the organizer? The answer is yes and no. Many genes, including these two, interact to organize the body plan. Such systems are complex, because genes can play many different roles during development. Noggin, for example, plays a role in the development of the body axis, but is also involved with a host of other organs. Furthermore, genes do not act alone to specify complicated cell behaviors like those we see in head development. Genes interact with other genes at all stages of development. One gene may inhibit the activity of another or promote it. Sometimes many genes interact to turn another gene on or off. Fortunately, new tools allow us to study the activity of thousands of genes in a cell at once. Couple this technology with new computer-based ways of interpreting gene function, and we have enormous potential to understand how genes build cells, tissues, and bodies. Understanding these complex interactions between batteries of genes sheds light on the actual mechanisms that build bodies. Noggin serves as a great example. Noggin alone does not instruct any cell in the embryo about its position on the top-bottom axis. Rather, it acts in concert with several other genes to do this. Another gene, BMP4, is a bottom gene. It is turned on in cells that will make the bottom, or belly side, of an embryo. There is an important interaction between BMP4 and noggin. Wherever noggin is active, BMP4 cannot do its job. The upshot is that noggin does not tell cells to develop as cells on top of the body. Instead, it turns off the signal that would make them bottom cells. These off-on interactions underlie virtually all developmental processes. An inner sea anemone. It is one thing to compare our bodies with those of frogs and fish. In a real sense, we and they are much alike. We all have a backbone, two legs, two arms, a head, and so on. What if we compare ourselves with something utterly different? For example, jellyfish and their relatives. Most animals have body axes defined by their direction of movement or by where their mouth and anus lie relative to each other. Think about it. Our mouth is on the opposite end of the body from our anus and, as in fish and insects, is usually in the direction forward. How can we try to see ourselves in animals that have no nerve cord at all? How about no anus and no mouth? Creatures like jellyfish, corals, and sea anemones have a mouth but no anus. The opening that serves as a mouth also serves to expel waste. While that odd arrangement may be convenient for jellyfish and their relatives, it gives biologists vertigo when they try to compare these creatures to anything else. A number of colleagues, Mark Martindale and John Finnerty among them, have dived into this problem by studying the development of this group of animals. Sea anemones have been remarkably informative because they are close relatives of jellyfish and they have a very primitive body pattern. Also, sea anemones have a very unusual shape, one that at first glance would seem to make them worthless as a form to compare to us. A sea anemone is shaped like a tree trunk, with a long central stump and a bunch of tentacles at the end. This odd shape makes it particularly appealing, since it might have a front and a back, a top and a bottom. Draw a line from the mouth to the base of the animal. Biologists have given that line a name, the oral arboreal axis. But naming it doesn't make it more than an arbitrary line. If it is real, then its development should resemble the development of one of our own body dimensions. Martindale and his colleagues discovered that primitive versions of some of our major body plan genes, those that determine our head-to-anus axis, are indeed present in the sea anemone. And, more important, these genes are active along the oral-aboral axis. This in turn means that the oral-aboral axis of these primitive creatures is genetically equivalent to our head-to-anus axis. One axis down, another to go. Do sea anemones have anything analogous to our belly-to-back axis? Sea anemones don't seem to have anything comparable. Despite this, Martindale and his colleagues took the bold step of searching in the sea anemone for the genes that specify our belly-to-back axis. They knew what our genes looked like, and this gave them a search image. They uncovered not one, but many different belly-to-back genes in the sea anemone. But although these genes were active along an axis in the sea anemone, that axis didn't seem to correlate with any pattern in how the adult animal's organs are put together. Just what this hidden axis could be is not apparent from the outside of the animal. If we cut one in half, however, we find an important clue, another axis of symmetry. Called the directive axis, it seems to define two distinct sides of the creature, almost a left and a right. This obscure axis was known to anatomists back in the 1920s, but remained a curiosity in the scientific literature. Martindale, Finnerty, and their team changed that. All animals are the same, but different. Like a cake recipe passed down from generation to generation, with enhancements to the cake in each, the recipe that builds our bodies has been passed down and modified for eons. We may not look much like sea anemones and jellyfish, but the recipe that builds us is a more intricate version of the one that builds them. Powerful evidence for a common genetic recipe for animal bodies is found when we swap genes between species. What happens when you swap a bodybuilding gene from an animal that has a complex body plan like ours with one from a sea anemone? Recall the gene noggin, which in frogs, mice, and humans is turned on in places that will develop into back structures. Inject extra amounts of frog noggin into a frog egg, and the frog will grow extra back structures, sometimes even a second head. In sea anemone embryos, a version of noggin is also turned on at one end of the directive axis. Now, the million-dollar experiment. Take the product of noggin from a sea anemone and inject it into a frog embryo. The result? A frog with extra back structures. Almost the same result as if the frog were injected with its own noggin. Now, though, as we go back in time, we are left with what looks like a huge gap. Everything in this chapter had a body. How do we compare ourselves with things that have no bodies at all? With single-celled microbes. Chapter 7. Adventures in Bodybuilding. When I wasn't out in the field collecting fossils, much of my graduate career was spent staring into a microscope, looking at how cells come together to make bones. I would take the developing limb of a salamander or a frog and stain the cells with dyes that turn developing cartilage blue and bones red. I could then make the rest of the tissues clear by treating the limb with glycerin. These were beautiful preparations. The embryo entirely clear and all the bones radiating the colors of the dyes. It was like looking at creatures made of glass. During these long hours at the microscope, I was literally watching an animal being built. The earliest embryos would have tiny little limb buds, and the cells inside would be evenly spaced. Then, at later stages, the cells would clump inside the limb bud, In successively older embryos, the cells would take different shapes and the bones would form. Each of those clumps I saw during the early stages became a bone. It is hard not to feel awestruck watching an animal assemble itself. Just like a brick house, a limb is built by smaller pieces joining to make a larger structure. But there is a huge difference. Houses have a builder, somebody who actually knows where all the bricks need to go. Limbs and bodies do not. The information that builds limbs is not in some architectural plan, but is contained within each cell. Imagine a house coming together spontaneously from all the information contained in the bricks. That is how animal bodies are made. Much of what makes a body is locked inside the cell. In fact, much of what makes us unique is there too. Our body looks different from that of a jellyfish because of the ways our cells attach to one another, the ways they communicate, and the different materials they make. Before we could even have a body plan, let alone a head, brain, or arm, there had to be a way to make a body in the first place. What does this mean? To make all of a body's tissues and structures, cells had to know how to cooperate, to come together to make an entirely new kind of individual. To understand the meaning of this, let's first consider what a body is. Then, let's address the three great questions about bodies. When, how, and why? When did bodies arise? How did they come about? And, most important, why are there bodies at all? Habeas corpus. Show me the body. Not every clump of cells can be awarded the honor of being called a body. A mat of bacteria or a group of skin cells is a very different thing from an array of cells that we would call an individual. This is an essential distinction. A thought experiment will help us see the difference. What happens if you take away some bacteria from a mat of bacteria? You end up with a smaller mat of bacteria. What happens when you remove some cells of a human or fish, say, from the heart or brain? You could end up with a dead human or fish, depending on which cells you remove. So the thought experiment reveals one of the defining features of bodies. Our component parts work together to make a greater whole. But not all parts of bodies are equal. Some parts are absolutely required for life. Moreover, in bodies, there is a division of labor between parts. Brains, hearts, and stomachs have distinct functions. This division of labor extends to the smallest levels of structure, including the cells, genes, and proteins that make bodies. The body of a worm or a person has an identity that the constituent parts, organs, tissues, and cells, lack. Our skin cells, for example, are continually dividing, dying, and being sloughed off. Yet you are the same individual you were 7 years ago, even though virtually every one of your skin cells is now different. The ones you had back then are dead and gone, replaced by new ones. The same is true of virtually every cell in our bodies. Like a river that remains the same despite changes in its course, water content, even size, we remain the same individuals despite the continual turnover of our parts. And despite this continual change, each of our organs knows its size and place in the body. We grow in the correct proportions because the growth of the bones in our arms is coordinated with the growth of the bones in our fingers and our skulls. Our skin is smooth because cells can communicate to maintain its integrity and the regularity of its surface until something out of the ordinary happens, like, for instance, we get a wart. The cells inside the wart aren't following the rules. They do not know when to stop growing. When the finely tuned balance among the different parts of bodies breaks down, the individual creature can die. A cancerous tumor, for example, is born when one batch of cells no longer cooperates with others. By dividing